Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write also happens to be what it takes to lead life you most want to lead. It's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA and their fast-approaching summer yearly Summer Writers Conference, which is going to be right at the end of July, July 25th, I believe it begins, you can go to pnwa.org. Yes, you can. But today, you know, I was thinking about history, because today's guest, Helen Bryan, is an historical novelist, but it seems to me that history is a story we keep telling ourselves, and the story keeps changing often, and as that story changes, I think so do we. I really do. And I would suspect that Helen Bryan does as well. Perhaps she's the author of two novels, historical novels, War Brides, and most recently The Sisterhood. But I don't want to speak for her. She's a writer, an ex-barrister. I'm sure she can speak for herself. So let's let her do that. Helen, welcome to the show.
Hello, Bill. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Helen, it is my pleasure. You know, let us start actually with history. Do you think...
All right.
As I said in my little intro... Well, actually, let me start here. I'm homeschooled my son this year, my 14-year-old son, and I was given the responsibility of teaching him what we call social studies here, which is really just history. And I was forever confronted with the challenge of making history relevant to his life here in 2013. As an historical novelist, do you find yourself having to do that, to try to make it relevant to the readers, or are you simply saying, let's take you back and have a look at things as they were?
Well, I do like to take readers back to have a look at things as they were, but you, of course, will be familiar with the saying that those who don't appreciate
yes.
history or understand history are doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
And I think that's very true. You know, with all the historical research I've done, and I have done quite a lot, I find that there's what I call the human constant. I don't think people change very much. And I think circumstances change, but I don't think people really change much in their essentials. And, you know, they're still driven by, if you like, considerations of you know, political considerations or a desire for wealth or religion or, you know, the biological imperative. But people are very much the same throughout history. They still, you know, they want to survive. They have goals beyond themselves that may be religious, may be political, but they also want to find happiness. They want to have families. They fall in love. And I think that what really history teaches you is that there is this constant in the human experience. And so it's always, anything you learn now, it may seem fresh and new, you know, to this generation, but really it's usually not anything that hasn't happened before and hasn't affected people, you know, in the way that we're affected or your son's generation will be affected.
Yeah, you know, it's true. Go ahead.
No, you don't go ahead. I was just going to say, I think the lessons just continue rolling on through history, and really anything you teach your son is going to be valuable in that sense.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things we ended up studying was the Roman Empire. We were learning about that, and we were studying the part where they first had to deal with the German, what they call the barbarian invasions of the, I don't know, around 300 BC or so, and that their response to it, because they were quite shocked that the barbarians were coming, all I could think of was America's response to when they were hit with 9/11, which is they became very conservative and immediately handed power over to a very powerful figure and sort of abandoned a lot of their democratic ideals because their safety was being threatened. And I thought, well, hasn't history just repeated itself 2,300 years later here?
I think that's such an interesting and valid parallel to draw. And it's interesting that you're teaching your son that sophisticated a lesson.
Well, whether he caught it or not, I don't know. I tried to show it to him. I don't know whether he picked it up. I don't know, but I was trying. Because I really am, that is a big challenge, is he will fight me tooth and nail and say, this is boring, this means nothing to me, why are you showing me this? And I'm always having to make that challenge. I feel like to some degree, every writer is always up against that of saying, why am I asking my reader to sit down with me? Why am I asking for their time? What is interesting about this? You must go through that, sitting down to write your novels. Why is this relevant?
Well, you know, because I'm always interested in whatever it is I'm writing about, I suppose I make an assumption that it's going to be interesting to someone else. And maybe that's a little bit arrogant on my part. But
No.
What I have noticed is that readers of historical fiction are remarkably well-informed bunch of readers.
Yeah, aren't they? They let you know when you miss a detail, don't they?
They do, and I think that's fantastic because it does tend to teach history in a way that, you know, sometimes we miss it earlier on in high school. I thought history was really pretty boring in high school. And then, you know, it's been my good luck to get interested in writing historical fiction somewhat later in life. And I wonder how many people that happens to. But as I say, I think the people who do choose to read historical fiction really are mostly quite educated in their subject, and they know what they like, and they know quite a lot of historical facts. And so I think, you know, I speak for an awful lot of writers of historical fiction when I say we've got to be very careful to get it right.
No, you absolutely do. I've heard this again and again from the historical novelists that I've talked to. And that's fine, because most historical novelists are interested in those details. I mean, you'd have to be you don't have to be, but I would suspect you yourself are very curious about exactly how it went down, and specifically the details of the world.
Oh, you do. You get sort of obsessed with the most nitpicking.
Right.
It's imaginable, but in a way that's what makes it it makes it interesting for the writers, and hopefully it makes it interesting for the readers too, because you know that you want to create a sense of what it felt like, you know, at a certain period of time, and you can't really do that unless you know what people ate, what they wore, what they thought, how they got about, the kind of weather they lived through, the kind of government they lived through, what their religious point of view might have been, so many tiny details.
Oh, and I would think one of the real, I mean, there's the one challenge of writing historical fiction is that all the little tiny physical details that I take for granted if I were to write about life here in Seattle in the 21st century. But then there's also the sort of biases and preconceived notions that the people would have 500 years ago, for instance, that it would take a great leap of imagination on my part to simply be able to presume. But there's certain things they're simply going to assume about men and women and about nature and so on that I know you must have to research, that you can't simply intuit.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting. When I was writing War Brides, which is about five young women in World War II, and one of the things I had to do was try and get a sense of the moral tone of the times. And by that, I mean you had to try and understand what sort of moral constraints these young women would have had or would have perceived. And that's not the same thing as saying, you know, there was a lot of There was a lot of sex, there was a lot of free love, there were a lot of illegitimate children and one thing and another. But the young women I was writing about might have stepped outside the boundaries, but you had to know what their boundaries were before you could, you know, indicate what the significance was of stepping outside those boundaries. And it's an interesting thing, and you really have to suspend everything that you think you know and try and understand it from someone else's point of view. And it's quite an interesting exercise.
Yes, and see, though, those boundaries are interesting because you have to make the reader understand why those boundaries matter.
You do.
Let's say about
you
having
do.
Sex outside of marriage, you know, and that's something not a big deal now, but then you really have to make them understand what that meant to take that risk, what seemed like a risk.
Well, I had one of my war brides was a very fast-living debutante, and she wasn't afraid of much. She was an heiress, and she stood to inherit some money. But even she realized that there were certain constraints on how she could be seen to behave.
Yeah.
And that just wouldn't apply, you know, today. You know, wealthy young women would do whatever they wanted to. But in those days, you couldn't just do what you wanted to. And I think that's been true for women in much of history. I know in the sisterhood, I'm writing about nuns and the kind of constraints that would have, you know, compelled women, whether they wanted to or not, to enter a convent. But there was kind of a moral mindset that you have to try and understand, and what was important. And, you know, it wasn't all about, well, if I'm in love, I don't want to do that, because chances are your mortality was limited in other ways. If you were quite likely to die in childbirth, for one thing.
Right.
And so going into it, a lot of people did have quite a spiritual dimension to their lives. You didn't have very good medicine, and, you know, your life was quite likely to be fairly short. And if you were a woman, it could be very short indeed, after a baby or two. And so I think that people were forced to look to other sources of, I don't know, not just consolation, but support and, you know, moral support. And how do I choose what it is that I do? What are the constraints on me? What are the constraints on the rest of my life? And what am I, you know, how do I make, I think people were making decisions perhaps in a slightly different landscape of, you know, what was possible and what wasn't possible.
Yeah, or what, and it's not even sometimes what is possible, but what they perceived as possible. See, it's so much easier for us now because the perception has been this been stripped away. But if you're the first one to be the first woman doctor, or the first slave to leave the plantation, or whatever, you're taking a chance into an unknown. And so, and I think it's hard for us to know now, but once upon a time, for a woman not to have a man to support her was kind of a life and death thing, maybe. How are you going to live? How are you going to keep a roof over your house, and so on and so forth? Now that's not so much the issue. I mean, maybe someplace, but certainly not in the West.
Well, that's certainly true. And I think what you have to understand is not just the, say, the woman's mindset, but the extent of that unknown. You know, as you say, if you were a slave leaving a plantation, you had absolutely no idea what was out there.
Yeah, yeah.
But you knew there was very little you could count on.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing was true for many women. For example, the woman who was the first doctor. If you've been told all your life, you know, you have an inferior brain and you can't do this. And then you sort of take the leap and you do it anyway, and undoubtedly encounter, you know, hostility and opposition, to say the least.
Yeah.
It's something to be reckoned with, and I think we look back and say, oh, well, that was the first doctor, the first slave to leave the plantation. But you just can't calculate from this point in history what it must have appeared, you know, how frightening that leap must have been at the time.
Yes, and that's the job of the writer then is to help the reader see through the lens that what that unknown means, because each of us, wherever we live, have faced an unknown, and we know what it is to have to open that door and go through it. And it doesn't matter if it's becoming a doctor or leaving the slave. The unknown is the unknown is the unknown, and we all fear it, or some of us embrace it. And so your job as a writer, it seems to me, is to help relate these historical unknowns to the sort of universal unknown that each person is contending with in their everyday life.
Well, I think that's very elegantly put, Bill. Yes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, all right. Hey, so let's talk about the sisterhood, because you, like you said, War Brides takes place in World War II. Sisterhood's a little before then. You've picked some nuns back in the 16th century. What made you travel that far back? What drew you to this story?
Well, what drew me to the story was, I didn't know it was going to be this story, but many years ago I was in Spain and I came across a very old convent in Madrid, and it was kind of a low-built convent, and obviously, you know, it was obviously quite old, and in fact it dated from just after the Reconquista in 1492, when the Catholic monarchs, Isabella and Ferdinand, had finally defeated the Moors, who had ruled Spain for nearly 700 years, 600 years, actually. And when I went into this convent, it was terribly atmospheric, and then I saw some things that made it even more atmospheric. There were some cases of toys. Just the corridors were lined with cases of toys, and the weird thing about the toys was they were nun dolls. They were little fittings for altars in churches. There was a kind of a doll's house made like a miniature convent. There was a doll-sized chapel, and just toy after toy after toy. And this was a little bit unusual. I had seen convents before, but I'd never seen anything like this. And apparently this had been a convent that had had an orphanage for the illegitimate daughters of the aristocracy. And these children were brought there as babies, and they grew up and became nuns and, you know, never left the convent.
Right.
And I thought that was really quite an interesting and sort of haunting concept. And I thought, gosh, this would be a really good basis for a story. And what if one of these girls, the orphans, disappeared and found love and went off to Spanish America, you know, in pursuit of,
right,
of, you know, life and love. And somehow the story kind of grew.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, because I had to research nuns, I had to research the Reconquista. I have been to Spain many times, and I know and love Spain, but there's something really intriguing about Spain, and you do get this sense of the Moors' footprints are everywhere. Everywhere you look,
yeah.
It's architecture, it's the way people behave still, it's the way towns are set up, it's food, it's everything. And I thought, there's this Moorish ghost in the background. Let's explore that a little bit. And that took me back further and further to, I don't know, Roman Spain. And there was this legend of three Marys from the Gospel of St. Mark who fled or were set adrift and wound up in the in the coast of Provence, and there's still a chapel and a shrine to them, you know, with their bones today. And I thought that's a haunting story too. I wonder if we can tie this in with the Order of Nuns. And then I thought, what if the nuns had been sheltering girls from the Inquisition? Because Spain did become kind of a police state in the very much, and it was frightening. And so one thing led to another, and all these things began to weave themselves into a bigger tapestry that I thought made a pretty good story.
You know,
so that's where it all came from.
You know, listening to you talk, I love to listen to writers describe how stories come together, because it is just endlessly fascinating to me how the human imagination works and how, for you, how that lit up and how the questions came and then how the details presented themselves to you and you were able to recognize the story. And it's just magical to me. And I think that what is also interesting about historical writers in particular, historical novelists, is how the research becomes such rich fodder for their story. I assume that you surrender to that experience, the knowledge that the research is going to take you someplace that you couldn't have guessed. Or maybe you go in with a preconceived notion. But every historical novelist I know is taken on twists and turns because of what they discover just in their research.
Well, that's so true. And as you know, I trained as a lawyer. So
yeah.
It's one of those things, you look at the evidence and you say, wait a minute. What happened?
It's like, yeah. It's but then you have to, you know, you made a point earlier that I totally agree with, and I want to say that again for our listeners, some of whom are probably writers, many of whom are writers, which is that if it's interesting to you, that's your clue that it might be interesting to somebody else. It's actually not arrogant. It's really all you've got to go on. Because you're alone at the desk, aren't you, Helen? And no one else is there with you telling if they like it or not. And so you've got to find the nearest person you can, and that's you. And that's where all the heat is. And I find it interesting that what I find most exciting is often what will translate best to other people if I really tap into what is really exciting to me.
Do
you have that
experience? Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. And I think most writers do that, and most writers of historical fiction do that. It's just one of those things that if you're fascinated, and I have never failed to be fascinated by history, it's so bizarre.
Right.
You couldn't make most of it up.
Right. No, it's true. But that's why you're good at it. You see, living within you has to be the reader of historical fiction, the one who adores these stories. So because that, you will meet your reader there in a way, you the storyteller, but you understand on some level why it turns them on so much, why it excites them in a way that a person who doesn't like historical fiction could never fathom. It's the depth of the understanding goes beyond the codes, too far below the superficial, I think.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And although I do write in what my husband refers to as lockdown,
I just locked down. No one. Yeah. No one can come in, right? No one. You don't show it to anyone.
No one can come in. It is just me.
Right.
But I have to say that once I am so interested by it, I just hope that someone else will be as interested. You know, I'm sort of saying, let me tell you a story about this. Guess what I found out?
Yeah.
And I hope that, and I always hope that works.
Well, I always think with art that it should feel like, in a way, when you, like, say, go into an old bookstore and discover this gem of a book and read it and say, God, this is great. I can't believe no one's ever read it. And then go and share it with your friends. Like, look, I found this great story. Wouldn't you like to read it? I think on the deepest level, even the stories we write can feel like that. Look what I found. Isn't this great? You should read it, even though you're the one who wrote it, but you still kind of found it, didn't you?
Well, I think, you know, in a way, found is not even a word I would use. I feel quite fortunate because these stories seem to come. They just seem to come. I don't know where they come from. But, you know, you do the research and suddenly you say, you know, there's this story that's kind of weaving itself together before my eyes.
Yeah.
And if it's that interesting for you, and if you want to go back and read it as someone who's, you know, written it down, then hopefully readers will have the same reaction to it.
Yeah, well, I think the more excited you are, the more, and I think it is our best way. You know, when you talk about finding, I'm always reminded of that quote by Michelangelo, who said, I didn't carve, I released the statue from the marble, which sounds you think, well, what do you mean? You know, you've got a pick and you've got a hammer and there it is. You're knocking it out. But I do feel like with a story, you're kind of like releasing it from all the possible things it could be, you know, for instance, all of history. But you're letting the story rise to the surface so that you can see it. Does that make sense?
I think it makes perfect sense to me because that is the way I feel. You just feel so privileged to be helping it to the surface,
yeah.
If you like.
Oh, but oh, such humility!
You
it's good.
Don't really take credit good. For it.
No, you can't. If you do, Helen, if you do take credit, you cut yourself off from the source of what provided you with the story in the first place. Because it'll say to you, you don't need my help, okay. It's all yours, baby. Enjoy.
No, you're just grateful that it comes.
Yeah, indeed you are. All right, well, so let me ask you this, Helen. I like to ask my guests this sometimes. First question I want to ask you is, when did you become aware in your whole life, this probably was from your childhood, that story, just story of any kind, was valuable to you, was interesting?
Oh, you know, I used to get read bedtime stories as a small child before I could read.
Yeah.
So I think I'm a huge fan of bedtime reading to children. But,
yeah.
I can still remember when I finally learned to read when I was 6 years old in first grade, and it was this sense of power.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
great. You know, I knew then I could do anything. And stories were always important, and I read a lot, and I was fortunate enough to grow up in a house full of books. And,
yeah.
you know, I think it's the best thing you can do for a child is give them plenty of reading material.
Yeah. Yeah, because it stimulates the imagination, and not just because you can dream of faraway lands, but as every writer knows, the reader is filling in so many details that they don't even realize they're filling in. And so your imagination is working away even as you're reading. Creating, actually.
Oh. Definitely. I think the best books pique your imagination.
Absolutely. All right, so another question I'd like to ask my writers when I get a chance is, I'd like you to finish a sentence for me, if you would. If you're ready?
All right, ready.
Okay, if writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what? What has it taught you?
What has it taught me?
Yeah.
I suppose it's taught me never to give up or shut up or...
Wait a minute, which is it, give up or shut up?
I think
they're
I mean,
different
both,
things.
Because I think writing is a form of communication, and you don't shut up.
Yes.
And even if people say, you know, I don't know if I really like this or not.
Right.
You stick with it.
Yeah.
I do think you have to stick with it. I think you have to be disciplined. I'm far more disciplined in my writing life than I am in anything else.
Oh yes.
Everything else can go to pot, but I just,
right.
you know, I have to get my writing in. And keep reading, really. The one thing I've learned from writing is that you can never read enough.
Yeah.
Nothing will keep you reading like writing.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Yes. Discipline, boy, you can't. Oh, well, I was going to say something profound, but forget it. Another time, maybe.
Oh, go ahead.
A little bird has told me it's time to go. Helen, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. I wish you all the luck with the sisterhood. I'm sure it will do fabulously. Where can they find you? Is there any place they can – do you have a HelenBryan.com yet or not?
I don't. It would interrupt my lockdown.
Okay. All right. Get it. All right. Well, Helen, best of luck. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much, Bill. I've enjoyed it.
Well, everybody, discipline. You really can't beat it. Get yourself to the page as often as you can. All you'll be doing is sharing the things you love. How hard is that? In the meantime, I will be away for a week, but I'll be back same time next week, 2 o'clock, as always, talking to somebody whose name escapes me right now, but it doesn't matter. I'll be here, and if you are, so will you. And until then, do what you love, write what you love, read what you love, because if you do, well, you can't go wrong, can you? All there is. Love is all there is.